Welcome to Talking Shop Down Under. It's not your normal host, Richard Banks, as you may have noticed by my accent. My name's Alex Mackey. I'm one of the senior consultants at Redify. And I'm going to be harassing Richard on his thoughts on Agile and the next version of TFS.
No, you're not.
Oh.
Oh, yes, you are. Oh, and before you do, though, I do need to plug a few things. So there's TechEd coming up. And if you're going to TechEd, you need to get your name down for Dev 305. That's the session to go to. Not anything that Alex is doing.
Yeah, that would be terrible. You want to keep away from HTML5. I mean, no one's going to use that.
No one touches HTML5.
It's not of interest.
No, it's not that no one's going to use it. Everyone already knows everything about it. There's nothing interesting. Whereas looking at a bunch of idiots showing how to build an MMO game. Hello. See?
Yeah.
Winner.
I'm not sure how you're going to fit that into your presentation, but okay.
I'm sure I'll figure out a way. All right, yeah, cool. You were going to ask some questions. Let's ask some questions.
Yes. So let's start off with, Agile, I guess, is going to feed more into the LM stuff rather than the other way around. So what exactly do you understand about the term Agile? It's something a lot of organizations claim to be. My experience has shown this is not always true. So what does it mean to you?
As in the broad term itself?
Yes.
So I come back to the Agile Manifesto at this point and just pretty much trot that thing out, because that's I know it's aging and people are saying, well, you know, we need to refine it because it's been going a while and whatever else, but it still does sum up the majority of what those set of agile processes stand for, which is individuals and interactions.
Yeah.
It's people first, not the process itself that is the most important thing. So you take any old process but you take the best process in the world and you put a bunch of numbnuts on it, then you're going to get rubbish results. And yet you can take a really bad process and put the best people in the world on it, and despite the process, they'll actually produce something good. So the most important thing really is the people involved in software. So software dev's hard, and any time you get a process that forgets that people are involved and treats them as resources, then you're going to have a problem. So that's probably one of the key things first up, and that's where most organizations fall down too, because most organizations don't put people first. They put resources first and resource plans and schedules and all that sort of thing. And every developer or every person involved in development, whether they're a tester, BA or otherwise, just gets treated the same. And so that in and of itself is a problem. And if you look at the various practices that get called Agile, so it's Scrum, XP, Crystal Clear, even MSF Agile to some extent, they all tend to realize that without the right people, you're not going to get a good result.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Then there's, individual interactions, customer collaboration over contract negotiation is another one. So this is really that point about, the way most organizations deal with hello, was that a phone?
Yes. In the background.
So what they're saying, so contract negotiations, the way most organizations work when it comes to doing development, so they deal with their, they still have that real project mentality instead of that application lifecycle mentality. And so we get a project, we have to deliver it on time. And of course, everyone wants the iron, you know, the fixed scope, fixed price, fixed deadline routine. And we know it doesn't work, but they go for it anyway. And an agile organization realizes that you're going to have, you're going to need to have some flexibility because change is going to happen. And so you might as well build that into your process from the start. So an organization doing Agile is going to realize that they need to be flexible in terms of, you know, exactly how much stuff gets put in or the time frames involved and so forth. And at some point, it's really just be pragmatic more than anything else. And the same with the working software over comprehensive documentation. Doesn't mean no doco, obviously. You still need to have documentation, but don't write 400 pages when 10 will do.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is get the software that works, not write the best document for software that never turns up. Huge amount of money gets burnt on documentation. Huge. And then no one reads it, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So what are the main sort of things you've seen when you've gone into various organisations who have claimed to be agile? You mentioned this bit about them treating people as resources. Some of the problems I've seen is they'll sort of try and come up and they'll say we're doing Scrum and all these sort of processes, and then they'll like fit this on top of planning stuff like 6 months in advance and then try and slot it into time periods and stuff. It sort of goes away from perhaps some of the philosophy around it. And one particular organization had I think several sort of estimation sessions for sort of each one, and they try and plan up to a year ahead or something of some of the work coming up.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you can plan a year ahead. It's not a problem, but the level of detail you plan at that point is going to be fairly coarse. So you can say, well, look, over the next three sprints or the next three iterations, we're expecting to get through kind of this much, and beyond that, we'll deal with some of these big epics, and we want, you know, these really chunky features, though. So we might have a 12-month development effort that we think we've got ahead of us. We don't know until we do it, but that we think is about there. And one of those features coming up down the track could be, I don't know, account management or something like that, because everyone seems to have that in business software. Or, you know, how do we deal with our customers or whatever else? And so some customer management, account management kind of thing where we're tracking details and addresses and whatever else. And we haven't really needed to work out the details, but we know that it's fairly chunky, and in 6 months or 8 months' time, we think we'll probably be dealing with that area of the system. But we don't need to be at that level of detail of, you know, this particular field is going to be on this particular screen at that point in time, because that's just stupid. Yeah. We don't know what we're going to need really until we've got other parts of the system working, and then we can let that guide us.
So how do you fit this into like a whole sort of release planning structure where they need to get various things on board, say, marketing campaigns and, I don't know, CDs burnt to be sent out and that type of thing, when they need a date?
Sorry, CDs being burnt?
Yeah.
So is this a software company?
Afraid to say.
So there's this thing called the internet.
Yeah, I'm familiar with this. What is this you speak of?
Okay, so marketing campaigns is a classic example. Or they've entered into an arrangement with a third party, and the third party's depending on some of their stuff, and they've agreed to a certain time frame for things to be done. When you've got those situations, you're really looking at a fixed time frame project, not a fixed scope. So what you want to be doing on your marketing campaign is not talking in detail. So you're saying, well, we've got this new product coming up, and the big features, the most important and wonderful things that we're going to have for you, we can talk about right now, because we're planning those to be done in the first half of our development effort, when we know we're going to get through that stuff. And then what happens, that it's kind of that last 20% of what you hope to get done is really your negotiation point. And depending on velocity and rate of progress and all sorts of things, some things might just have to slip into the next version. And Microsoft does this all the time. You know, they talk about the next version of Visual Studio and whatever else, and they'll have a whole list of features, or even Windows. They've done this in the past with things like, you remember WinFS, the Windows file system?
Yep.
That ended up getting dropped because of issues in development and so forth. But they never committed to it. And so the next version of Windows, when it finally rolled around, was always talking about features that were either done or almost done. So that they didn't launch, say, we're going to have this wonderful feature, and it never showed. And so marketing campaigns should be done the same way. And then you can stick to a common date, and you can have a launch date, and you can say, we're going to be launching the next version of Visual Awesomeness in, you know, April 2012, along with Windows 8 and next version of SQL Server and all these different things. They might line up at the same time. Not saying they will, but, you know. Then it's just the details of which features get in and which features don't. So having that ordered, prioritized list of your backlog and making sure the important stuff that you're talking about gets done first is obviously fairly critical.
Yeah. So a lot of the ideas, they seem sort of fairly sensible around some of the Agile stuff. But is there any actual sort of academic studies that have evaluated the effectiveness of this?
What, of Agile processes?
Yeah, in being able to deliver a project that is actually what people want, is on time, higher quality, any sort of attribute, I guess, that you can measure.
So there's the Chaos Report, which the Standish Group does, where they look at different projects and so forth across different organizations at success rates and failure rates and what are the factors for success and which ones aren't and so forth. And of the factors for success, six out of the top 10 pretty much come from agile project approaches.
Yeah.
And then, but, you know, you still get a couple in there from the classic waterfall style projects as well. And there's nothing that says you can't be successful with a waterfall project as well. It's just you're more likely to be successful with agile in certain environments. So if you look at projects, they generally fall into, I suppose, four categories. You got the really simple ones where you don't really need any process at all. You can just chuck one guy at it for a couple of weeks and it's done.
Yeah.
You've got the other end of the scale, which is the chaotic project, which is hundreds of people and no one knows what the hell's going on and what are these requirements you speak of? Let's just make it up as we're going, and it's really reactive and so forth. And those situations, no process is going to help you because you really just need someone to come in and grab the thing by the scruff of the neck first. And then there's the complicated projects, which are, you know, maybe ones where you know what the requirements are, but you're doing something with a new piece of technology, so you're not sure what you're going to get bitten with yet. Yeah. Or you know the technology really well, but you're doing something where the requirements are a little bit grey and there's going to probably be a little bit of change. So either of those approaches, you can be successful with either waterfall or agile, though your success rates will still vary in that. And then there's the fourth category I haven't mentioned, which is the complex project or the project where there's more that's unknown about the requirements and the technology and so forth than there is that is known. And in those cases, being able to respond to change instead of following that waterfall plan just like a lemming and running off the cliff is really important. And so that's probably what leads to success. Scientifically, is there any scientific surveys or anything like that that comes up and says one's better than the other? Nah, it's more anecdotal.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, here's the trick. If it's in software development, if it's been done before, we're not going to do it again.
That's true.
Because we're just going to take the same software that's already been written and reuse it, right?
Do you think there are some projects that might actually be better suited to a waterfall approach?
Depends on the organization culture more than anything else. So I'd say it's some organizations more able to adapt versus others who really want to be very plan-driven. You know, people often bring up things like hardware projects, for instance, as a reason to do a waterfall approach because you've got these long lead times to put things in hardware and you've got the expense of casting dies and so forth. But there's nothing that says you can't do a whole lot of agile work right up until the point where you've got your design set and you've simulated it and you've tested it in the simulation and then you go and etch a die or whatever else and then find out if the thing worked properly or not.
Yeah.
And there's been evidence of that. But, you know, air traffic control systems, for instance, often run, you know, projects around those things often run in a waterfall manner more because of the number of dependencies they have on external organizations.
Okay. Well, so what's Kanban and how does that relate?
Kanban or Kanban. task tracking, very simple. Kanban just means task board. And so all that happens is you throw things up on the task board and you track them through their various states. And when they're done, move on, pick up something else. The key idea behind it is more limiting your work in progress. So it's not so much the board that's important. It's knowing how many things you're going to be handling at various points. So, yeah, it's based on theory of constraints, which is a project management approach. comes more out of manufacturing sector than anything else. And so you look at your flow from end to end. How do you get from your raw materials to your finished goods and then out the door to the store, for instance, or to your customer? And what are the states it goes through in terms of being processed along the way? And if you don't limit your work in progress and you work on keeping all your areas busy all the time, then what you end up doing is stockpiling a whole lot of work in progress right before you're the slowest part of your system. And that adds to the cost overall of your production because you're building up all this stuff just to keep machines busy. And it's the same in software development. If you end up with a whole lot of things in progress, you end up with a whole lot of inventory that you're carrying, and the cost of development becomes higher because now you're task switching between all these things. So in development, that's really what are your decision gates? So to everything in software development, if you think about it in stages, are really a series of decisions that we make, you know, decisions at a code level, decisions at a design level, decisions at a requirements level, etc. And any time you're handing off to someone else to get a decision is another state that you're moving into.
Yeah.
And the more decisions that you pile up, the longer it takes to turn those things around and be able to move on again. So by limiting work in progress, we're limiting the number of decisions we have to make, and therefore it just shortens that decision loop, making things faster for us overall.
Cool. And so where do you see sort of methodology and stuff progressing next? Bit of an open-ended. What do you see happening next in this particular area?
I have no idea. I think what we'll find in terms of, let's say we look at it from a few areas. So I think we'll find, I suppose, the what you would call the unagile, agile approach being taken, where the large corporates who are used to doing that very waterfall style see that these agile projects are working well, and they go, ooh, I want a piece of that, baby. And then they'll jump in and they'll say, oh, you know what? Let's take on the shape that these agile things do, but we'll miss the heart of it. We'll miss that individuals and interactions thing, and we'll just make people do stand-ups, and we'll do them in short little chunks, and they will have some improved success, but they're not going to get any real benefit out of it. And they'll call themselves agile and whatever else, and it's just going to muddy the waters over what things are. And then we'll also see at the other end, the startup community, I suppose, despising some of what they see there and probably coming up with a different name for things that is inherently the same, but they can call it something else so they feel like they're more special.
Maybe some martial arts related name.
Oh, yeah, like, I don't know, judo fu.
Something like that. Yeah, maybe we should invent.
We can invent one. We can just take something that exists and relabel it. Who does that?
And then we have certification for it and charge people and stuff.
I think in terms of process, it'll be more a gradual refinement. So the key thing with any agile process is also that continual improvement approach. So if you get nothing else out of moving to an agile process, you should try and embed that continuous improvement thinking and style into the organization. Because once that comes, then you'll just gradually morph into whatever suits the organization best, hopefully.
Okay.
If you don't and you don't see gradual change, then you're doing it wrong. But what we'll also see, I think, is a lot more tooling vendors trying to get in on the action. So we've seen it over the last couple of years with an explosion of these various different approaches to, you know, Scrum tool vendors or Kanban vendors or, you know, X, Y, and Z trying to support process X, A, B, and C. And I think that's going to continue for quite a while. But those tools at the moment are really focused around the development space. I think what we're going to see is an extension from the development space into operations and back out to requirements. So we're already seeing it a little bit with acceptance testing, the fitness tools and the cucumbers and so forth, trying to drive that BDD style approach, letting the requirements, executable requirements turn up. And I think we'll see some more there. And that will change the way development interacts with the business, which could in turn result in a better process overall. And if nothing else, it'll at least give us better quality, I hope.
Cool. Well, moving away a little bit.
Yes.
With Agile. ALM.
ALM.
Is this some crazy new buzzword that Microsoft have come up with?
No, it was started by... who started it? The Gartner Group, I think.
And what exactly is ALM?
Application Lifecycle Management. All it really means is a combination of processing tools to help you manage your software across its lifetime. So all the way from that initial project through the development, through the maintenance phases, so on and so forth until you eventually retire that thing in 20 years.
Cool. And Microsoft's offering in this space Visual Studio and TFS.
Yep.
And currently, what sort of issues are you seeing with TFS, current version? Or what issues
are people... I think it's... No. Source control sucks.
Why? What aspects of it?
Anyone want to say read locks on files?
No. And what sort of problems are you seeing around that?
So the whole issue is really workspace management more than anything else with source control. The fact that the server is the boss of what it thinks it's got on your machine. And if anything goes wrong, people are looking, my machine's got this file, where the hell? What? And they get all upset. Plus the fact that the TFS source control system locks files for edit so that they're all marked as read-only, so you can't go to the file system and just quickly hack something. That said, this week Brian Harry made public the news that we're getting local workspaces in TFS, which effectively gives us a much better offline scenario as well as removing the read-only lock, so we can go into our local file system, change files, and Visual Studio will automatically pick up that there's been some amendments, adds, deletes, etc. So that should ease a lot of the pain that people currently have with source control. It's still not a DBCS, and it's still not a plug-in model.
Do you think it will be? Has anything been announced around that?
No, Brian has simply said that DBCS is in the future. So he says, not yet, we're looking at it, not yet. So I don't think it'll be in this version. In fact, if it, you know, in the next version, if it showed up, I would be absolutely gobsmacked. But that said, I think DBCS is still have a little way to go to grow up as well. So Microsoft's good at following technology trends in a lot of areas instead of instigating them. Obviously, Connect and things like that, a little bit different, but in terms of the developer space, they generally try and target just behind the curve.
Yeah.
So not the bleeding edge or the leading edge, but just a bit back from that, because that's where the massive corporate developers end up. In this space, we deal with some of the corporate developers, and they still think SourceSafe's a good thing.
I don't think too many think that anymore. There's probably the odd one that is quite happy with it. So what do you see as the main advantages of DBCS?
The local check-in and branching model. And the fact that you can muck around with things locally and then when you're happy with it, push it in up to the server as either an aggregated change, single change set, or as your individual little changes. It also just encourages a more rapid change and check-in model.
Yeah, because, I mean, often you're quite afraid to – I mean, maybe you create a branch or whatever, but there can be that sort of thing where you want to go play around with something and you might want to revert it back again.
And knowing that you're working in a local branch, if you screw it up, you just delete the branch and create a new one.
Yeah.
And you go, hey, no harm done. No harm, no foul.
Have you seen many sort of big corporations move to a DVCS or
– No, but obviously at this point I should plug Git TFS.
Git TFS.
Yes, Git TFS, the Git front end for TFS as an open source project, which I've contributed a little bit to.
Was that the disclaimer there?
Yeah, so be careful. Your mileage may vary. If you go to github.com/Sprints, Sprints, he's got a project on there called GitHub. So called GitHub, called Git TFS, which basically... treats TFS as a remote for Git. So you can just do pushes and pulls from it, which makes
sense. Have you used this one commercially? Or?
I use it almost by default. So if I ever turn up somewhere and I can plug my laptop into the network and connect to their TFS server, I'll just use Git TFS in front of it, and away you go.
Well, one of the things I found quite painful with my limited experience of TFS is working offline and then going online again.
Yeah, and that's going to get fixed in the next version. The offline scenario at the moment is a pain in the butt.
It seems to cock it up every time.
Yeah. So
to the point where I won't do anything.
Yeah, so you've got to consider what Microsoft actually built DFS for, which was their own internal use as well. And internally, they've got gigabytes of source code. So if you look at what DevDiv produces and you listen to some of the stats around how many files there were when .NET 4 was launched and all that sort of thing, you know in particular that it's just massive amounts of source code floating around. And TFS as a version control system handles that, and it handles it well because of the server-side model. But also there's the idea then that all their devs are on the LAN all the time, and they've got their machines plugged in all the time. They're not really grabbing their machine and carrying it home with them because they're all on chunky desktops and so forth. Or if they need access, they'll just VPN in and away they go. And the reality is that most organizations aren't even close to that, and they have small code bases of less than a couple of gig, if that, usually less than a couple of hundred meg. And a lot of them nowadays have laptops, and they'll just plug their laptops in and take them home with them and so forth. And occasionally people want to do things like code on the bus or the train. that'll be sorted out. But TFS, coming back to it, in terms of application lifecycle management, at the moment it covers the architecture, development, and testing parts of that process. The next version is really launching into requirements gathering. So they've got a PowerPoint based application now, where you can go in PowerPoint, draw up your UIs, and do some mock-ups and so forth, and then push that information into TFS, which is very nice.
Yeah, that was, I think, one of my favourite.
Yeah, it's like Sketchflow done right, or
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of people do that anyway in PowerPoint.
Absolutely.
That's users, and I think that's a great move.
Or what people do these days is they grab Balsamic, mock something up in there, and cut and paste the image into PowerPoint.
It's maybe slightly better than that.
Yeah. And then it's the other end as well, going into ops. So they've got a link to System Center now. So if your ops team or your IT pros have System Center and they've got an issue with the production version of the app, let's say they're running the app and they're looking at the perf counters, and the perf counters are saying, well, the CPU is maxing out and the load's only 5 users on the system, they can actually take one of the alerts from System Center and push it back into TFS as a bug and so forth, and be able to trace requirements through that way. So that's improving. There's still no automated deployment story really with the next version of TFS, which is unfortunate. So it's going to be a case of you just do another build type that pushes, if that's what you're doing, or you use TFS deployer or something like that. So yeah, it's extending that whole process from requirements through to the through to production now. So that's really what you want to look at in your application lifecycle management tools, that just that integrated view across the whole thing. It's just unfortunate that the source control has been such a pain, because people generally use that as the first port of call, and because that's been poor.
I thought the interface was fairly poor as well, to like the adding work items and getting a good view across what's going on there. It seemed perhaps one of the most friendly of tools for that type of thing.
Yeah, I think the issue there is you look at some of the Agile tools that focus purely on Agile, and they can take some shortcuts around how they do things because they have a single focus that they're doing. TFS, from a design point of view, Microsoft wants to make sure it can cover lots of processes, so it ends up being a bit more like Jira. You know how Jira's UI is a bit naff at times. Hello, Atlassian.
I quite like Jira, actually.
Yeah, but you know what I mean by the UI. It's a bit ugly, and there's lots of fields and so forth. And TFS is much the same. There's lots of fields, and it can be customized, obviously, same as Jira can. It's not too hard to customize if you know what you're doing.
Telerik's view of it looks quite nice, actually.
Yeah, I think you'll find the next version, or the cloud version, is going to change a lot, because the UI is much nicer.
So have they confirmed there'll be a cloud version?
Yeah. They talked about it at TechEd in the US this year, showed some of it running. It's got the inbuilt task board now that you would expect in Agile tools. It's much more focused on the Agile side of things than the waterfall side of things now, so it's deliberately Agile.
And when we say cloud version, is that a version hosted by Microsoft or a version you can put in, say, Azure?
Either, but there's definitely going to be a hosted TFS.
Cool.
The other one will be an on-premise one, and if you do on-premise and choose to use your on-premise in Azure, then that's, I suppose, something that might or might not work. I don't know. I haven't asked about that. But, yeah, the hosted TFS is all web-based. It's got a really nice UI for adding things, so you can quickly add work items, which is yeah. nice. Instead of having to do the whole rigmarole you have to go through at the moment. So looking forward to seeing that running, which will be good.
Cool. I mean, I remember at the MVP Summit, some of the people coming out of the ALM sessions, they just said, wow. And obviously due to NDAs and whatever, they can disclose on some of this. Yeah. But they were like the only people sort of blown away.
Nah, they've actually talked about a lot of this. There's a white paper floating around with the TFS vNext.
Yep.
And so Visual Studio vNext, I think it is, a white paper showing not only some of the TFS specific features from the server side, but also some of the changes in Visual Studio. So for instance, Visual Studio at long last will natively support other unit test frameworks.
Yes.
Yeah, baby. XUnit, here we come. And it's also got a new diff tool. So it's got an inline diff tool, sits inside Visual Studio, and you can do side by side inside the same code window, or you can do overlaid mode, which is really cool. And what's really good feature is the code review tool. So a lot of organizations do code reviews using various things like SmartBear, Code Collab, for instance, or what's the Atlassian tool? Is it Crucible? Might be. I can't remember. But basically the idea is you go through and you look at a diff and you can make comments on various lines in the diff and then feed that back to the original developer, who will then pick it up and make their own commits and changes.
Add your WTF.
Yeah. What the hell are you thinking? And that's inbuilt inside Visual Studio, that whole review mechanism now, which is just excellent.
Well, it sounds really awesome. Have they hinted at any dates that this is going to be coming out?
I don't know.
Okay.
And if I did, I couldn't tell you, right?
Sure.
All right, so thank you, everyone, for listening. We're going to wrap up here. That has been another episode of Talking Shop Down Under with your host,
Alex Mackey.
Oh, yeah, I like it. And the guest, Richard Banks. And we will see you on the next show. Until then, happy coding. Catch you later.
We won't have that guest again.
Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.